Hello, I'm Dr. Atul Gawande, and this is a download from my 2014 BBC Wreath Lectures series. My theme is the future of medicine, and this lecture is called The Century of the System.
Hello, and welcome to the second of this year's BBC Wreath Lectures. A double welcome, in fact, because today we're in the home of the Wellcome Collection in London. Sir Henry Wellcome was a medical pioneer. He died in 1936, but his legacy, the Wellcome Trust, lives on. Its vision, and I quote, is to achieve extraordinary improvements in human and animal health. So we couldn't really be in a better place to listen to this year's lecturer on the subject of the future of medicine. Last week he described how and why doctors fail. This time he's discussing systems. If they can be better designed, he says, healthcare the world over can be completely transformed. His title today is The Century of the System. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the BBC Wreath Lecturer 2014, Dr. Atul Gawande.
Well, what a great pleasure. Thank you. Every country is struggling with delivering effective medical care to their populations. They're struggling for a variety of reasons. You know, we blame the problem on money. We blame the problem on too much regulation in healthcare. We blame the problem on too much business in healthcare. We battle it out over all of these kinds of issues. It becomes political everywhere, rich, poor, and in between across the world. But what I think is the central challenge underlying those battles is that the problem of making care better everywhere is ultimately a problem of complexity, the extreme complexity of what we're trying to do. And I'm going to start by describing to you a case report that I read. It came out in 1999, and it was how I learned what to do to take care of somebody who's drowned. So this was a case report that laid out the treatment following a case of a three-year-old girl. She'd been in a small town in Austria. It had been a winter day. Her parents had gone out on a walk with her, and it was one of those terrible things. The parents lost sight of their little girl just for a moment, and the next thing they looked, and she was out on the surface of this icy fish pond, and then she fell through the ice under the water and was gone. They ran, jumped in after her, and they could not find her. It was more than 30 minutes before they finally felt a limb at the bottom of this pond, pulled her up to the surface, got her to the shore, and she was, of course, not breathing. The parents called the local emergency services from their mobile phone, and the operator on the phone gave instructions to tell them how to begin doing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. So they began doing chest compressions, and a team was dispatched. The rescue team arrived 8 minutes later, and they took the first vital signs at the scene. The girl's temperature was just 66 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 30 degrees below normal. She had no pulse. She had no respirations. And most ominously, when they shined a light in her eyes, her pupils were what they describe as fixed and dilated, meaning they did not react to light. The pupils were just stuck wide open. And what that means is the brain is gone. But nobody wants to give up on a little child. And so they continued to do the chest compressions, the CPR. She was loaded into a helicopter. They took her to the nearest hospital. There, they bypassed the emergency room and went straight to the operating room. And what they wanted to do was begin warming her. The most effective way to do that with someone who has no heartbeat, no respirations, was to put her onto a heart-lung bypass machine. That's no small matter. In order to do that, you have to cut down over the groin and expose the femoral vessels. You have to plug in inflow and outflow lines to the cardiopulmonary bypass machine. They have to prime the pump, start the flow going. And then gradually, you had a machine now taking over for her breathing and her circulation. By this point, it had been more than an hour and a half since the last time she had taken a breath. They gradually warmed her blood and her body. You can't warm too fast, or you're going to end up rupturing the red cells. And so it was 2 hours before they could raise the temperature just 10 degrees. But at that point, her heart began to beat in a normal rhythm. And what they realized is they had one organ back. Over the next 6 hours, they raised her temperature in her body, warming her gradually, gradually, until it came up to the normal 98.6 degrees. And then at that point, they thought they would try to see if they could put her on a ventilator that would breathe for her, that would push oxygen down through her windpipe. And they found that that did not work. The oxygen wasn't getting through because her lungs were too full of pond water and debris, they found, for the oxygen to penetrate to her bloodstream. The cardiopulmonary bypass machine was made for heart operations. It wasn't meant to be something, it wasn't made to be something that people could stay on for long periods of time. So they had to bring in a different machine. It's an artificial lung called an extracorporeal membrane oxygenator, or ECMO. Now this machine had to be plugged in an entirely different way. For this, they had to open her chest with a saw. They had to plug the inflow and outflow lines directly into her aorta and the right atrium of her heart. They had to remove the other pump from her groin and repair those vessels. But now, with this machine turned on, they now had an artificial lung for her that could bring oxygenated blood into her bloodstream, and her heart would keep on pumping. Now, with this machine, they had to pull a big sterile drape over her open chest and wheel her on her table with this machine out of the operating room and into an intensive care unit where she could be managed. For the next day, every hour, they took a bronchoscope and suctioned out the fluid that was in her lungs. They tried to wash all that debris out. And 24 hours later, when they tried to put her onto a mechanical ventilator, they found the oxygen got through. Two organs back. And this was the way it went. They worked on every part of her body, how to bring her kidneys back, her liver back, her gut back. And after 2 days, they found that all the organs were back except one, her brain. But she was stabilized enough that at this point they transported her out of the ICU downstairs to the radiology suite where they could do a CT scan of her brain and look to see whether there was any damage there. And what they found that was that her brain had swelled to the limits of her skull, but there were no dead zones that they could see. And so they decided to keep going. They called the neurosurgery team. Because of the pressure they saw on the brain, the neurosurgery team drilled a hole in her skull, put a pressure probe all the way down into her brain. And then with that pressure probe, they had the readings on the pressure there, and they could dial the medicines and the fluids up and down until they could gradually lower the pressure inside her brain. She remained comatose for a week, totally unresponsive. But then her pupils began to react to light. And then she began to breathe on her own. And then one day, she simply awoke. Her eyes opened, and she was there. 2 weeks later, she ended up going home. Now, it still wasn't over. Her right arm and leg were paralyzed. Her speech was severely slurred. She had to get intensive physical therapy, educational therapy just to learn what she could learn, how much speech she could bring back. And 2 years later, they brought her back to the hospital for a round of neuropsychological testing and physical testing. They found that physically, her strength was completely back. She was equal on both sides of her body. And what's more is that they found her psychological capabilities were exactly where they were supposed to be for someone of her now 5-year-old age. She was, in other words, after all of that, just like any other little 5-year-old girl that you and I know. Now I'm reading this case report about how you save somebody from drowning. And there are two things that struck me as I'm looking at this. Number one was the extent of the capability that we have discovered that we could take somebody who had gone without breathing, 30 minutes underwater, CPR for another hour, and that they could come back, that we had the capabilities to bring them back. But the second thing was, holy cow, how do you do this? The extent of what was required to pull it off seemed almost impossible. Everybody had to get every step right. There were dozens, probably hundreds of people involved in the course of care along the way. And any one of those people make a small mistake, you know, one nurse who forgets to wash his or her hands and lets bacteria get in under that drape with the open chest, and it was over. Now, what I think, when we come to understanding what it means to really deliver on the discoveries of the last century, is that I think we have been fooled by penicillin. Penicillin discovered not far from here, St. Mary's Hospital, 1929, by Alexander Fleming, and it was another almost 20 years before it really became something that could be mass-produced and brought into communities, that penicillin could come as an antibiotic that could stop disease. And when it arrived in our communities, it came as a miracle. The miracle was, for one, that we'd found this treatment that could eliminate whole classes of disease, you know, a whole body of bacterial infections that we basically thought, you know, you couldn't do much of anything about. But the second thing was, it came as a miracle because it was so easy. It was just an injection. Now, that made us imagine that this was the future of medicine, of healthcare in general, that we would just have an injection for cancers, for heart disease, for stroke. But the truth that emerged from this last century of discovery is that, you know, very little of it has turned out to be like penicillin. It's been much more like trying to make sure that you can replicate what that team did for that little girl who drowned, that it can be incredibly complex. In fact, I've argued that what we are facing when we try to deliver on the discoveries that we have, we're facing extreme complexity. You know, across the United States and Europe, we know, despite all of the money we put into healthcare, that 40% of our population who has coronary artery disease receives incomplete and inappropriate care. We know that 60% of our asthma patients, or of our population that has high blood pressure, the biggest killer in the world, 60% receive incomplete or inappropriate care for those conditions. Closes in on 90% for certain mental health conditions. Consider just the fact that we have 6 million people in our hospitals who pick up infections that they didn't have just because somebody has failed to follow the basic infection control procedures that have been known for decades. So how do we understand what this is really about? You know, you go farther and you realize it's a more general problem than just something that's happening in medicine. We have made tremendous discoveries, but find it's extremely complex to deliver on them. We have inadequate homicide investigations, for instance. We have flawed software design. We have intelligence failures. We've had tottering banks. And what we see repeatedly, again and again, I think, is that as we embark on the 21st century, we have found that the 20th century has given us a volume of knowledge and skill that is beyond what any individual can simply hold in their head, can know how to deliver on, and simply do it on their own. The volume of knowledge and skill has exceeded our individual capabilities. So how do we try to solve that? How do we go about improving the performance of what we do in medicine or beyond it? Well, you know, I think we have had one core idea, and I call it the primitive idea. And that core primitive notion is that we really just need to tell people, you ought to do X. You ought to do this thing we tell you to do. It might be washing hands. It might be how you take care of a drowning girl. It might be how you investigate a homicide properly. You ought to do X. And what do? We teach you in classes. We train you along the way. And then we find you may not do it later on. And so then we went to the medieval approach. You must do X. We've issued standards and guidelines and regulations. We'll take away your license if you don't do this. Or if we're being nice about it, we'll pay you more if you do it. You know, we'll give you incentives. And that did make improvements in matters, but only a bit. It didn't get us to what we want. And what we want in the modern version of the world is that the norm is to do X. And the way that we make it the norm are systems. And they can be as simple a system as just checklists. It can be defaults. It can be feedback loops. The important insight is that what we have to focus on is how to deliver on the guidelines and standards and knowledge that we have discovered, how to make it easy for everybody to follow. One of my colleagues said that we are graduating from the century of the molecule to the century of the system. And by that, what he meant was that we've gained an enormous amount in the last century by focusing on reducing problems to their atomic particles. You know, discover the gene that underlies disease, or the neuron that underlies the way our brain works, or, you know, the super specialist that can deliver on a corner of knowledge. But what we're discovering is that as we graduate into the future, we are faced with a world where, you know, it's how the genes connect together that actually determine what diseases actually do. It's how the neurons connect together and form networks that create consciousness and behavior. And it's, in fact, how the drugs and the devices and the specialists all work together that actually create the care that we want. And when they don't fit together, we get the experience we all have, which is that care falls apart. The basics end up being known, but they're not followed. And so we were approached by the World Health Organization several years ago with a project to try to reduce deaths in surgery. I thought, how can you possibly do that? But it was exactly the same kind of problem. The basics were known, but not necessarily followed. And so we worked with a team from the airline industry to design what emerged as just a checklist, though, that was made specifically to catch the kinds of problems that even experts will make mistakes at doing. Most often, basically, failures of communications. The checklist had some dumb things. Do you have the right patient? Do you have the right side of the body you're operating on? Have you given an antibiotic that can reduce the infections by 50%? Have you given it at the right time? But the most powerful components are, does everybody on the team know each other's name and role? Has the anesthesia team described the medical issues the patient has? Has the surgeon brief the team on the goals of the operation, how long the case will take, how much blood they should be prepared to give? Has the nurse been able to outline what equipment is prepared? Are all questions answered? And only then do you begin. Well, the result after we tested in 8 cities around the world, including right here at St. Mary's Hospital in London, in Toronto, in Seattle, also in Delhi, in Tanzania, was that in every hospital that used the checklist, the experts found that their complication rates fell. The average reduction in complications was 35%. The average reduction in deaths was 47%. And it's been replicated in multiple places. Scotland has implemented it and taught it at the front lines, and they have now demonstrated that 9,000 people's lives have been saved over the last 4 years. Now, what we know is it's clearly not just the checklist. It's not some piece of paper you hand out as a kind of tick box exercise. We've had to form an organization called Lifebox that brings these capabilities to the low and middle income world. And what we found is the hardest part is to bring the culture that has the humility to recognize that even the most experienced people, even the most expert, fail. And that we need the humility to be able to understand that. But across many fields, we're seeing now that our design has been around the idea of the individual instead of the system, around the drug or the device or the specialist, the reductionist ideal, instead of how it all fits together. We fear these kinds of systems. We fear that it'll be a loss of daring, it'll be a loss of heroism. But we surveyed surgeons and asked them, what do you think about this approach 3 months after they adopted it? And we find that about 20% or more really dislike it. It's paperwork, it's a pain in the butt, I don't want to do this. And then we ask, if you're having an operation, would you want the team to use the checklist? 94% did. And what you discover is that discipline makes daring possible. Now, when I read that article about the drowning girl, my puzzle was, how did they do that? You know, this was not discovered in Harvard, where I am, here in London. It wasn't at some mecca. It was in a small community hospital in the Alps in Austria. So I called up the first author. It was a young cardiac surgeon named Markus Thalmann in Klagenfurt, Austria. And I said, how did you do it? And he told me the story. He said, you know, we have dozens of people who are caught in avalanches every year, and we find them frozen, the equivalent of being drowned, and I was convinced we could save them. And so the first way that we went about trying to do it was said, here's everything that needs to be done, now let's just do it. That's what the surgeon does, right? We say, just do it, damn it. And it didn't work. And so then he looked at the failures and he realized that the problem was a lack of speed. You needed to have an array of things at the ready. You needed to have the pump available and primed and ready to go. You needed to have the emergency room team prepared. You needed to have the trauma surgeon, the cardiac anesthetist, the perfusionist, and always something wasn't there. You know, the anesthetist would be at home when they were supposed to be called in, and that's 30 minutes away, or the machine wouldn't be ready. And so what they did was, they made a checklist, and they gave it to the person who had the least power in the system, the telephone operator. And the telephone operator got the call and could activate the checklist. They could call up the anesthesiologist and the cardiac surgeon and tell them, you need to come in from home now. The engineer would get the machine ready. And this was the way they had their first survivor, that little girl. And since then, when I called him, he said they'd had many. And he told me about the most recent. He said that there was a mother and a daughter who'd been in a car, and they were driving on an icy mountain road, and the car skidded on the ice as it lost control, hit a guardrail, instantly killing the mother. The car went through the guardrail, over the cliff, and into a mountain river, and then went under the water. The emergency crew got there just in time to see the car going under the water. They had to use the jaws of life to get the door open under the water. I don't even know how they did that. And then they got the girl to the surface again with more than half an hour with no breathing under the water. But from that point on, the system went like clockwork. The hospital was notified. They arrived within minutes. They bypassed the emergency room, went straight to the OR. They crashed onto the bypass machine. They got the heart back. They worked on getting her lungs back, moving the fluids and the drugs. They were able to get this process going even faster. And here was the result. The next day, all her lines and tubes were removed. And the day after that, She was already sitting up in bed, ready to go home. Thank you.
Brilliant. Atul Gawande, thank you very much indeed. Let me now open up the subject to the audience here at the Wellcome Collection in London, where we've got leading professionals in medicine and in public health, as well as those of us who simply seek to keep healthy and off that operating table. There's a questioner here.
Hello, my name's Becky Hind. I'm an operations manager at Heathrow Airport. I wondered if you, listening to your work on teams and complexity, wondered if you looked outside of the medical industry for any ideas around organising complex operations such as we do at the airport.
Yeah, very much. In fact, in order to even come at how we would attack this question in surgery, what we did was we brought in the lead safety engineer from Boeing to come with us. He didn't know anything about healthcare, but when he saw the way that we even approached the problem of improving outcomes in surgery, he was sort of baffled that, you know, he would watch how I went into an operating room, and I'd go into an operating room, and I'd just start operating. And he said, hold on a minute. Is this really what you do? Have you made a plan with everybody? Everybody knows what to do. They all know what to do. You guys know what to do, right? Oh, yeah, we know what to do. And then we'd watch one thing fall through the cracks, and then another, and then another. It took him only a moment to step back and say, you all need some basic communication systems around the idea that a team has to be effective at what they're doing. So I think that there are lessons very much coming from other fields. Here's the big difference. There are two people in a cockpit trying to make something happen. And in many clinical environments, it's many more than that. My mother went for a total knee replacement, and I counted the number of people who walked in the room in 3 days, and it was 66 different people. And so the complexity of making 66 people work together, you know, you'd have a physical therapist walk in the morning, they'd say, what are you doing in bed? You should be out of bed. And the physical therapist would come in the afternoon, it'd be a different person, and they'd say, what are you doing out of bed? You should be in bed. This is still where we are.
Hi, my name's Shewan Thomas-Gibson. I'm a gastroenterologist in London. Thank you, that was fascinating. We've introduced your checklist in our tertiary centre for endoscopy, and believe me, it was a struggle. We had more than 20% of doubters.
Why did they doubt?
Well, I wouldn't say that we have some surgical endoscopists because that would be too easy. But no, it was precisely for the reason that actually we have a relatively easy procedure, if you like, procedure base. And so it's not seen to be complex. But we were having complications and we were having errors in the system, not always errors with consequence. They were often errors without consequence. But that's where you can intervene. My question was really around, I think you mentioned LifeBox, and to take it right back to something you said right at the beginning, which is that rich and poor countries have problems with healthcare. And so using something like a checklist can make a big difference, I think. No one would argue with saving the life of a small little girl, but for the cost of that, why can't we afford clean water and vaccinations that would save thousands of little girls elsewhere in the country? Can our checklists and can LifeBox, I'd love to hear more about it, can that help thousands more?
Just give us a sentence on what LifeBox is specifically before you answer that.
So this is the nonprofit organization that we started to bring the basic ideas of the checklist and the teaching of it into low and middle income countries.
Okay.
So whether it's Eastern Europe or in Southern Africa. Why would it be so difficult in her own unit? And the answer is error is rare now. You're talking about 1 in 100, 1 in 200. And to cut that by 50% is massive when we do millions of these procedures. But day to day in your life, what you experience is, I feel like I'm perfect. So why do I need this? Right? Well, the same thing happens in the low-income countries where there's even less of the tradition of the same kind of professionalism and demand for accountability, transparency, and safety. You go further, though, and you know this question of, well, why are we concentrating so much effort in these kinds of areas? Can't we make sure that just the basics are delivered in other places? And I don't see it as either or. Two reasons. Number one, we were still trying to rescue that drowning girl. She's going to be a phenomenal expenditure of money. And if we can actually do it right, she's going to get to live and contribute in the world and help us in the future. And you know, everywhere we see, when you work to make these complications get solved, we're saving substantial money instead of making it worse. The second is that many times the approaches are very simple. We have a checklist that we've designed now for childbirth in poor countries, and what we found was that the most basic failures were ones of failing to wash hands, for example. 1% hand washing before a child delivery that we're observing in places that have a 6% death rate for newborns. 1 in 16, where you know we're used to 1 in 2,000.
But what about clean water for these people, which is exactly, I mean, why can't it be extended to provide something as basic as that?
But this was, this to me is that kind of example. We went into this clinic, they say, we don't have clean water. It's on the checklist. And then you begin to say, how do you solve this? Let's bring it into the room and use the cleaners to get it there. So it's that kind of problem solving that has to be embedded into part of this.
I'm going to a question here.
My name's Simon Chaplin. I'm Director of Culture and Society here at the Wellcome Trust. We're in a venue that's dedicated to exploring the intersection between medicine, life, and art. And I wonder, in your vision, is there still a place for creativity and innovation in medicine?
It is everywhere. Now, what's interesting to me is that the version of creativity and innovation is changing. Creativity and innovation was seen as a solitary kind of enterprise, the scientist at the laboratory with their test tubes or their rats. But you know, the place now for innovation and discovery and how you make the systems work around us are, you know, the laboratory is a completely different realm. So making systems our laboratory is messier in certain ways, much harder to control, but phenomenally creative. And that's where I've enjoyed it.
But in a hospital system, if you're going to reduce or elevate, whichever way you get to look at it, everything to a kind of tick box system, mm-hmm. aren't you going to ossify medicine? Aren't you going to hinder innovation?
That's precisely the danger. So there's the bad checklist and the good checklist, right? So the bad one is one that turns people's brains off. More often than not, the effective checklist asks people questions that they have to discuss and get their ideas forward. And that was out of a scientific process that we identified. And it's made in ways to help an expert be even better at what they do.
Okay. Maureen Baker, Chair of the Royal College of GPs. You mentioned the challenge for healthcare is extreme complexity. Do you think a systems approach has something to offer in the management of ongoing multiple conditions? The management of hypertension when it's a single disease condition is pretty easy by and large. It's very difficult, complex and dangerous when it's one of four or more ongoing conditions, and it's often what you don't do benefits the patient as much as what you do.
No, it's absolutely true. What you realize is the job of the GP, but also of all physicians, but especially the primary physicians, is dealing with variety and the complexity of the number of conditions. And what we've never studied, we've not even made it a science yet, is who is more effective in managing that complexity? What are they doing that makes them more capable of managing that time? I think we're learning is that more often than not, they are members of teams. And that those teams are people who can take someone who has 10 different problems and address priorities that the patient and doctor set for themselves, but then follow through on it, calling them up every couple of weeks. How are we doing on that smoking goal? And by the way, are we keeping your prescriptions filled? Dramatic improvements in outcomes, costs, reduced hospital admissions. We're starting to see this now.
Costs, I would have thought, would go up if you were doing all that kind of thing and following people up and ringing them up. And
so there's an investment up front, but the thing that you're preventing is these are people who end up having fewer visits to the emergency room, fewer admissions to the hospital.
But it's a long game, is what you're saying.
It is the long game.
I'm going to a question here.
Thanks. Nick Black, Professor of Health Services Research at the London School of Hygiene. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the role of patients as key players within the system, rather than the system as being entirely a sort of technocratic professional activity?
Well, I'll give an example where we have a chronic, huge problem that we under-deliver on, the biggest killer in the world, bigger than smoking nowadays in places like the UK and the US where we've gotten smoking down, high blood pressure. You know, for the most part, 60% or more of our populations who have severe high blood pressure don't have it under control. Now, there are known things that doctors and nurses can do to make sure people are on effective drugs, and that if they have side effects, that we adjust them so that they're not having those problems. But the most effective programs also allow patients themselves to be in control of the medication and to be able to adjust the medication based on their own blood pressure. So that ability to use known approaches, systems that give more autonomy and authority to the public around their own care can be fundamentally important in
driving these kinds of
approaches.
But that's an education process, an educational process that takes time, doesn't it?
It's not just education. It also even is the system you build in. So, for example, say your blood pressure is high today, that you're allowed to increase your own dose. Right now, we don't allow it. We can even introduce an app on your phone. All of these things are innovation spaces that have barely been entered. I mean, we're certainly not investing in them, and here is one of the biggest killers.
I'm coming. Question here and down here.
Ali Parsa, Chief Executive of Babylon. Babylon tries to deliver most of the healthcare we need on our day-to-day life through your mobile phone, through interaction of humans and machines together and the patients. I started my career as an engineering physicist, and in engineering physics, we never would have thought anymore to do everything by human brain. We use artificial intelligence to help us capture what we know. In medicine, we don't do that. What are your views about the use of artificial intelligence in medicine?
You let me bring up what I think is the next stage of development in improvement of performance. The complexity we're talking about means that we're not ready to automate all of it. And yet there are huge components that I think actually could be automated. Even certain kinds of operations might be able to be automated themselves. So I think we're entering that phase where we're going to see some opportunity around diagnosis and perhaps around treatment, being able to start automating certain components
of
these more and more.
So do you see the patient going into, or not even going into a doctor's surgery? I mean, if you had your genome mapped, you could simply sit in front of a computer and answer a series of questions and diagnose yourself.
The power is going to
be diagnosed by a computer.
I'm more and more convinced that the power is going to come from how human beings and automation come together. So you work with a doctor who helps confirm that you have high blood pressure, but then you might be able to work with a program that does more or less most of your management of how to get that blood pressure under control.
We're getting pressed for time now, and I've got several hands up, so I'm going to go here if we can.
Sally Davis, the Chief Medical Officer. You've made me feel profoundly uncomfortable this evening on a number of counts. The first is, if people think you can rescue from drowning like that in general, they should understand that you've talked about people who were seriously chilled. So with good treatment like you gave them, there is an opportunity. The second is that in this country, thanks to a backbone of excellent general practice, actually hypertension is not the biggest cause of the problem, it's smoking. So the big question I'm left with is, of course, you're a surgeon, so you deal with sick people. But the real issue we're facing is, how do we stop them getting sick? And the big problems are weight management, lack of physical activity, smoking and alcohol in our society. So how do you bring your century of the system out to play to have a big impact on that?
Well, thank you for the cautionary notes. Very important that people understand it's the drowning in the frozen water or the avalanche.
Absolutely.
That makes it worse, because that stops, keeps you in a suspended state of animation. Second, we will have to talk about whether it's hypertension or tobacco at this stage, and I would love to have that discussion. But it clearly is the case that the chance to keep healthy is going to be, I think, tied to some of what we were talking about earlier. It's teams, because the ability to recognize whether in a GP's practice you have certain people who have as their goals the ability to, if they have five different problems, how to tackle those goals, or it might be around, you know, just some very simple things. The most important thing they can work on is reducing smoking, and then there's a team that actually works really effectively on getting that smoking stopped. Now, some component of it is also that it doesn't even have to involve the healthcare system directly. It is everything from our devices that can monitor how much we're walking and how much we're consuming and give that feedback loop directly to you is also potentially avenues that will be open to us in the next few years to turn care around.
Are you persuaded, Sally Davis?
I think you're beginning to get there in those last few comments. Thank you.
It's put you in your place.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to take a last question here.
I'm Claire Marks. I'm the president of the Royal College of Surgeons, and I'm here to defend you just for one moment. But actually, what I really wanted to mention was that I looked after a patient who was one of the guinea pigs for penicillin. And penicillin was given in 20 mil injections four times a day intramuscularly. It was agonizing. And the only thing that enabled him to carry on was the compassionate care of the people who delivered that. And in all the systems that we put together, really the most important thing, I think, is the understanding of the compassion and caring that has to go with that. Do you have anything to make us all into compassionate, caring clinicians?
Fundamentally important, and in fact, the subject of my entire next lecture, at a minimum, it's about our ability to connect with people and understand their priorities in their life. And being able to capture that and understand the skills required around how we're able to do that really turns out from the second thing, which is not just recognizing people have priorities besides just being alive, it's being able to ask them what their priorities are. And we haven't learned those skills and we haven't incorporated them into what we do. But the power of it is that I think we're discovering how there are even ways to reach that goal of simply being human beings, caring for human beings, while having all the advantage of these systems around us.
It's a good place to end. Next week, we shall be in Edinburgh when Atul will be looking at the great unfixables in healthcare, aging, and death. Until then, our thanks to our hosts here at the Wellcome Collection in the Euston Road, London, and of course, to our Reith lecturer, Atul Gawande.